Lecture 34, The Bush Still Burns, The Expansion of Calvinism. Going to be talking today about the Reformed faith as it spreads outside of Europe to different parts of the world, including Australia. And I'd like to begin with a prayer from Ernest Northcroft Merrington, an Australian Presbyterian. Let us pray. God of eternity, Lord of the ages, Father and Spirit and Savior of men, thine is the glory of time's numbered pages. Thine is the power to revive us again. Pardon our sinfulness, God of all pity. Call to remembrance thy mercies of old. Strengthen thy church to abide as a city set on a hill for a light to thy foe. Head of the church on earth, risen, ascended, thine is the honor that dwells in this place. As thou hast blessed us through years that have ended, still lift upon us the light of thy face. Amen. Going to add a bit to the outline today, so you may at times feel that you're lost, but most of it is there somewhere, although I will change and add some. One of the five themes that I set out in the beginning of the syllabus, one of the five themes that I want to cover, and I hope to some degree we have in this course, is the theme of ecumenical and reform. We've tried to take from time to time a big look at the church as it develops in various ways and in different traditions, but we have also been concerned to focus more particularly on the developments of the reform tradition within church history. This lecture is going to focus especially on the reform side of that theme, and then the next three we'll look at the ecumenical side, as we'll look at developments in the 20th century in the Protestant Church in general, then the Roman Catholic Church, and finally the Greek Orthodox Church. I wonder if you could think of the most Presbyterian, the most Reformed countries in the world in terms of percentage of population. You probably would get some of these right. Switzerland and Scotland would stand at the top with about 40% Presbyterian and Reform. Many of those would be nominally connected with those churches, but nonetheless some kind of identification with the Presbyterian Church. Holland would be next with about 30%. And you may not get the next one right, but Hungary would be next with about 20%. I want to say a little bit about the development of the Reformed faith in Hungary before we look at its expansion to North America. Hungary had influences going back to the pre-Reformation period because of the popularity of the teaching of the martyr John Huss in Hungary and adjoining areas in Eastern Europe. Luther's teaching in time came into Hungary and many people embraced Lutheranism, but it was really the Swiss Reform, the Helvetic Reform, that became the most popular shape of Protestant Christianity in Hungary. A Hungarian scholar has talked about the amalgamation of the spirit of Bullinger and Calvin in the Hungarian Reformed Church. In 1567, the Second Helvetic Confession, you remember that was Bullinger's great personal confession that was later adopted by different Reformed churches in 1567, that confession of Bullinger was adopted by the Hungarian Reformed Church as its own confession faith. A Hungarian Bible was published in 1590, and by the end of the 16th century, it was estimated that 80%, perhaps as much as 85% of the population of about 3.5 million had converted to Protestantism. Most of those were Reformed, some were Lutheran. It's interesting, too, to realize that during the early 17th century, the great influences from Puritanism from England poured into Hungary and brought a renewal and revitalization of the Hungarian church at that time. But by the time that was happening, the forces of the Counter-Reformation were being felt, and in the second half of the 17th century, that brought great reversal to the Protestant cause. It was a time of war and suffering for the Hungarian people, and a dramatic decrease in the percentage of the population which was Reformed, from about 80% down to 30%. Continued suppression of the church and of the Protestant cause by the Habsburg rulers contributed to decline in the great Hungarian Reformed Church, which at one time was probably the strongest Reformed Church in the world. From the 18th century down to the present, the Hungarian Reformed Church has struggled to hold its own, and has done that in terms of numbers, but has suffered at the same time a rather disastrous decline in theological orthodoxy and in spiritual life. So we need to remember something of the history of the church in Hungary and pray for that church today that God might revive it and restore it. The Presbyterian Church in the New World developed largely through immigration, particularly through Scots moving to other parts of the world. Scots were both Presbyterian and given to wandering and settling in other areas. In the United States, it was the Scotch-Irish that came over in large numbers in the 18th century and brought the Presbyterian faith with them. The Presbyterian Church had already begun in America before the Scotch-Irish arrived. The first American Presbytery began in 1706 in Philadelphia, which for many years was almost like a Presbyterian Jerusalem. The General Assembly was held there every year, and almost anything that happened in the Presbyterian Church in this country focused in Philadelphia, but then later other parts of the country as well. In 1706, there were seven ministers that comprised that first presbytery. Those ministers were from England and from New England and from Scotland and from Ireland. But it was during the 18th century that the great Scotch-Irish immigration took place and greatly strengthened the Presbyterian Church. Some Presbyterians came directly from Scotland. The first Presbyterians, or the first Scots to arrive in this country, were slaves, indentured servants, almost like slaves. They could work and buy their freedom, but it generally took them many, many years to do that. Those Scots were sent to America by Cromwell in 1651. Others came voluntarily after the defeat of the Jacobite cause at Culloden in 1745. But far more Presbyterians, Scottish Presbyterians, came from Ireland. You know, the Scotch-Irish are not really Irish. They're Scottish people who immigrated to Northern Ireland and spent a generation or two in Ireland and then many of them moved on to North America. Over 200,000 came during the 18th century, many of those people sailing from the Irish village of Londonderry on small boats, taking that perilous voyage of weeks and sometimes months, depending on the weather. Many came into Philadelphia and then gradually moved westward, some going out as far as Allegheny or Pittsburgh, as it was later called. And that part of Pennsylvania became one of the strongest Scotch-Irish and Presbyterian sections of the country. Those that did not push straight west went west for some miles and then turned south through the Great Valley of Virginia, made their way down the valley, settling in the different counties between the Shenandoah and the Allegheny Mountains. Augusta County and Lexington County are probably still the two most Presbyterian counties in this country. And then these people pushed on down into the Carolinas and finally out into Tennessee and Kentucky through the mountains as those states open up. There is a Scotch-Irish display at Western Carolina University in the little mountain town of Cullowhee, North Carolina, part of the Mountain Heritage Center, which in very interesting ways describes the migration of the Scotch-Irish from Scotland to Northern Ireland, down through the Shenandoah, and finally into the western areas of North Carolina. There were other Scots, Highland Scots, who came directly from Scotland during the 18th century. Smaller groups of Scots settled in places such as the Cape Fear area of North Carolina, where there is a Scotland county today, and a little town called Old Hundredth for the hymn tune, the psalm tune, and some people still speak the Gaelic language in that area of North Carolina. And so the Scotch-Irish came, the Scots came, and with them came the Presbyterian Church. Although the church was established before this immigration, it certainly strengthened the Presbyterian Church in the American colonies. As the Reformed faith was coming from Scotland, it was also coming from the Netherlands. There was a Dutch Reformed Church in America from the very early days of New Amsterdam. You realize that New York, as we call it, was a Dutch city at first, called New Amsterdam. As early as 1624, there were Dutch people living there, and the Dutch Reformed Church was planted. 40 years later, the city became English, but the Dutch still lived in the area of New York City, up the Hudson, and down in New Jersey. We saw that at the time of the First Great Awakening, Theodore Frelinghuysen was Dutch Reformed pastor who had a great deal to do with the beginnings of the First Great Awakening. Reformed Church in America, as it was called, was organized in 1792. In the 19th century, there are new waves of Dutch immigration. Scottish immigration is largely in the 18th century. Dutch immigration is in the 19th century. And not to the eastern seaboard or to the south, but to the Midwest, particularly to Iowa and Michigan. Tulla, Iowa, and Holland, Michigan became important centers for Dutch settlers and important places for the Dutch church. As the church in the Netherlands went through various secessions, so did the American Dutch church. The Christian Reformed Church was formed in 1857 by Dutch people who left the Reformed Church in America. There were two strands in the Christian Reformed Church, the seceders of 1834 and the followers of Kuyper, who came out of the state church in the Dolianti. You talk a little bit about Canada. Calvinists came early to Quebec, or Lower Canada, as it was first called. Quebec was founded by the French in 1608, just 1 year after Jamestown, 1607, and before the Pilgrims arrived in New England, 1620. Those French who settled Quebec included some Huguenots, Protestant Calvinists. But as Quebec became more and more Catholic in its orientation, the Huguenots were banned in 1633, and Lower Canada became a Catholic area exclusively until Quebec fell to the British in 1760. At that time, Scottish Presbyterians began to come into Montreal and other areas of Quebec. You might know that McGill University in Montreal is a Presbyterian university. It was a kind of Canadian Princeton with connections with the College of New Jersey, and some of the teachers at McGill studied at Princeton. Nova Scotia and the Maritimes became British possessions earlier in the 18th century, and many Calvinists settled that area of Canada, people from New England. Later, after the Revolutionary War, there were Americans who did not want to be independent but still had loyalty to Britain, and people from New England moved up to the Maritimes in Canada, including Calvinists, not so many Presbyterians from New England because there weren't many there, but Congregational Calvinists from New England, and they were joined by Presbyterians from Ireland and from Scotland. The same thing happened in Upper Canada, which is Ontario. Presbyterians arrived from the United States, from Scotland, and from Ireland. And in Canada, as we would expect, there were the different divisions in the Presbyterian Church that had already taken place in Scotland. So there were seceders, burghers and anti-burgher seceders, and then later Free Church Presbyterians. Some of these groups I haven't even talked about, but all of the Scottish Presbyterian divisions were recognized and existed in Canada. But by 1875, almost all Presbyterians had joined together. A good bit earlier than happened in Scotland, forming in 1875 the Presbyterian Church in Canada. In the 20th century, Reform witness in both the Presbyterian churches and some Reform witness in Baptist churches and other churches in Canada had considerably weakened. You probably know that in 1925, the United Church of Canada came into existence. Virtually all the Methodists and almost all the Congregationalists and about three-fourths of the Presbyterians joined in the United Church Canada in 1925. There was a continuing Presbyterian Church of Canada. That church today has some ministers, a minority, but some ministers and congregations committed to a revival of Reformed doctrine and Reformed faith. And also the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, is present in Canada, and a few congregations attempting to revive and recover the historic Presbyterian and Reformed position in Canada. several graduates of Covenant Seminary in recent years are ministers now, Canadians, who have gone back to Canada to serve in the PCA in Canada. In the 20th century, Dutch immigrants arrived in Canada, and most have become members of the Canadian part of the Christian Reform Church. The best one-volume history of the Protestant churches, the history of the Protestant churches in Canada, was published in 1990 by the Canadian historian George Rolick. I think it's important for us to note, too, that Mark Knowles' 1992 History of Christianity in the United States and Canada gives significant space to the development of church history in Canada. Americans have tended to ignore Canada and leave out the history of the church in our adjoining nation. There are some very interesting similarities between the history of Christianity in Canada and the history of Christianity in the United States, and some very great differences as well. And I think one way to understand the history of either country, the church history of either country, better, is to know the history of the other country by seeing how our paths tended to at times merge and at times separate. Helps us a great deal to understand American history or Canadian history. Next, the expansion of Calvinism in Australia. The first British colony was established in Australia in 1788. It really seems quite late when you think of the history even of the United States, which isn't all that old either. You probably know that the first colonists from Britain did not go to Australia voluntarily, but it was a penal colony, and these people were forced to go there. Doesn't mean that they were all bad people. People were sent to Australia for all sorts of things, like debt and other things that would not be considered reasons for imprisoning people today. But that history does mean that Australia did not have in its founding the religious purposes that this country had, for instance, with Puritans coming to America to escape religious persecution in England in order to establish their own faith freely in America. But it doesn't mean either that religion was not important in the history of Australia. The Church of England was present early on, and the Church of England in Australia included from the very beginning evangelicals and Calvinists. The early ministers of the Church of England, including Samuel Marsden, who's perhaps the most famous of that list, were influenced by people like William Wilberforce and Charles Simeon. And so they brought to Australia a very vital Orthodox Anglican faith. The result of that is the fact that even today the Diocese of Sydney is the most evangelical Anglican diocese in the world. Presbyterians soon arrived in Australia. These Presbyterians were from Scotland. The first Presbyterian preacher came in 1822. The first presbytery was formed in 1832. The disruption in Scotland in 1843 produced similar divisions in Australia, so that Australia, like Canada, had the different Scottish oriented Presbyterian churches, until later reunions produced two major Presbyterian denominations, the Presbyterian Church of Australia and what became known as the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia, where most of the Scots had settled, which continued and still continues the pre-Church of Scotland tradition. The same story that happens everywhere, and story that we'll look at in more detail next time in connection with late 18th and particularly 19th and early 20th century history, is the gradual decline of orthodoxy into liberalism. That happened in Australia as well, leading up to the Uniting Church in 1977, which was a union of the Methodists, the Congregationalists, and the Presbyterians, repeating about 50 years later what Canada had done already. But once again, there were some Presbyterians that refused to go into the Union, and so there is a continuing Presbyterian Church of Australia and the smaller continuing Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia and several other small Reform denominations, including a Dutch denomination, Reform Churches of Australia, founded by Dutch settlers after World War II, people described as the spiritual sons of Kuiper. The story in New Zealand is similar. Scottish Presbyterians came to New Zealand in the 1830s. Many of them settled around a city they called Dunedin. Interestingly, the old Gaelic name for Edinburgh. The Anglicans had settled at Christchurch, the province of Canterbury, so these people take their names with them, and the Presbyterians were at Dunedin. There was also a free church after the disruption of 1843. Those two churches united in 1901, and once again the trend was toward liberal theology in the Presbyterian Church in New Zealand. The Westminster Fellowship was founded in 1950 in that church to conserve the distinctive Reformed testimony of the Presbyterian Church of New Zealand as a daughter of the Scottish Church and so of the Calvinistic Reformation. A new Reformed Church was formed in 1953 by settlers from the Netherlands. There's been some interesting and encouraging historical work done on the Presbyterian Church and really the evangelical movement in Australia in recent years. Stuart Piggin, a very fine Australian historian, has written Evangelical Christianity in Australia. Concentrates largely on Anglican history, but includes important and helpful material on the Presbyterian and other churches. And then in 1994, the Australian Dictionary of Evangelical Biography came out. That startled some people who did not realize that Australia had an important evangelical history. I remember reading one review of that dictionary that the reviewer said he expected it to be a pamphlet, not a big book, but there are 700 entries in that dictionary, and it has helped to establish the significance of the evangelical heritage of this country, which is only 200 years old. One of the decisions made by the editor was not to include anybody who is still living in that dictionary. So that is a kind of problem, because that eliminates the last 50 years effectively, which is a fourth of Australian history, and means that people like Marcus Lone and others do not have an entry. But this is the beginning, and there can be a second edition someday. So some encouraging work done in church history in Australia, which I think will be very helpful in helping us not only to understand Australian church history, but to see how history is done in Australia to help us to do it in other places as well. Stuart Piggin's book particularly is a very interesting, insightful, opinionated book, kind of book I like to read, where he's not real cautious about everything. He really puts it out there the way he thinks it is. American historians tend to be much more cautious and balanced and nuanced, which may be good in some ways, but not nearly as interesting. Next, let's look at the history of the Reformed faith in South Africa, Dutch colony. In South Africa dates from the 1650s, when the Dutch settled Cape Town in order to have a place for provisions for their ships sailing around the Horn of Africa and around the tip of Africa. Of course, as soon as the Dutch arrived, the Reformed Dutch Church arrived, and as the Dutch Church is divided in the Netherlands, so the same thing happened in South Africa. There was the state church, the Dutch Church, Dutch Reformed Church, also the secession churches of 1834, and then later the Dolianti churches of 1886. Not only did Dutch people come to South Africa, but English and Scottish people as well. After 1795, there were ministers and missionaries from the London Missionary Society and other societies that sent missionaries to South Africa to work with the settlers, but also to evangelize the native South African people. Andrew Murray came from England. He was the father of the famous author and preacher of the same name, Andrew Murray. You may know something of his writings. Andrew Murray, the second Andrew Murray, is very important for his ministry in the Dutch churches of South Africa and for his spiritual writings on prayer, meditation, and devotion. One of the great English missionaries to go to South Africa was John Philip. He was a member of the London Missionary Society, a Calvinist, great sympathy for the native peoples, for the black peoples of South Africa, and he tried to help them and to evangelize them. When I was doing my doctoral dissertation at Princeton, I got into the student records of the Student Society of Missionary Inquiry at Princeton and found letters that the Princeton students had written to John Philip and his replies. It's very interesting that the Hottentot people of South Africa with whom John Philip was working, these people were praying for the Princeton students back in New Jersey. And the Princeton students were praying for the Hottentot people of John Philip early in the 19th century. I don't have time to describe the decline of Calvinism and the Reformed faith in South Africa, but let me just point out three causes for that decline. I don't mean that the Reformed faith is missing now in South Africa. It's still a very important part of the religious milieu of the country. But Methodist influence grew in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mr. Mandela is product of one of the Methodist missions. His early education and training and influence came from the Methodist, and he often refers to that. Also in South Africa, there was not a real Calvinist, Reformed, evangelical presence in the Church of England like there was in Australia. And then finally, the Reformed faith in some disastrous ways became connected with apartheid. Some people supported that, some people did not support that within the South African Reformed community. community, but by and large, the Reformed Church did not nearly do what it should have done in order to object to that way of life and to stand with their black brothers and sisters in South Africa in repudiating apartheid. Some did, but not many. It's now a new day for South Africa, and we can hope and pray that it's also a new day for the Reform faith in South Africa. I started by saying that the four most Presbyterian and Reform countries in the world, in terms of proportion of Reform people in the population, are Switzerland and Scotland and the Netherlands and Hungary. What do you think is the fifth most Presbyterian country in the world? Korea, exactly right. South Korea. Almost 7 million Presbyterians, which means over 15% of the total population of South Korea. In sheer numbers of Presbyterians, South Korea may be the most Presbyterian country in the world, ahead of the United States and any of the other countries that I have mentioned. Also, as you look at the Presbyterian Church in Korea, you discover that Korean Presbyterians have done what Presbyterians do everywhere, but they have done it more aggressively, and that is divide into different churches. Samuel Moffat says there are 45 different Presbyterian denominations in Korea. Well, I won't attempt to sort through all of that except to say there are two large Presbyterian denominations, the Presbyterian Church of Korea, called the Tonghap Church, which is more within the ecumenical framework of Reform churches worldwide, and the Presbyterian Church of Korea, the Hap Dong Church, which withdrew from the World Council of Churches in 1959. Well, this is an amazing story when you think of it, because Christianity came to Korea just a little over 100 years ago. We think of the history of Australia, we have at least 200 years, but history of Christian history of Korea, just 100 years. A Korean named So Sang Yoon was converted by Scottish missionaries in Manchuria. This man returned with scripture portions in Korean to form a Christian group in his home village. The next year, 1884, the first resident foreign missionary arrived, a Presbyterian doctor, and in 1885, the first Presbyterian clergyman arrived. One of the secrets of the growth of the Korean church is what is called the Nevius method. John Nevius was a Princeton student who went to China as a missionary, and there began to promote a certain way of planning the church and organizing missions so the churches would be self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating. That had some influence in China, but it had tremendous influence in Korea as Koreans took hold of that idea, and the Nevius method flourished in Korea. 1907, the first Korean presbytery was organized. And this is important, too. 1907, First Presbytery was organized, and that First Presbytery sent out the first missionary. So the Korean church, from the very beginning, was a missionary-minded church, with the beginning of its organization also being the beginning of its missionary activity. which has become so important today as Korean missionaries are serving the Lord in many, many parts of the world. 1945, there was the tragedy of the division of North and South Korea. Many of the Protestants, and most of them were Presbyterians, lived in North Korea. Two-thirds of the Presbyterians and the Protestants of the country were in North Korea. Some of those fled to the South, but North Korea has become officially a very non-Christian country. Only now are there some slight signs that there might be possibility of activity, Christian witness in North Korea once again. But the Presbyterian churches in South Korea have continued to grow at a rate that is impressive and challenge to Presbyterians all around the world. I do admire the Korean church because it's a church of prayer and it's a church of missions. So we can forgive those Presbyterians. There are many divisions, at least overlook some of those, and we have to because the PCA is also a church that has divided, we think and hope, over important issues. But the Korean church is an example to us all in its commitment to the important matters of prayer and outreach. And John Nevius was a student at Princeton. He was trying to decide what to do with his life. He was attracted to all kinds of opportunities and ministries, both in this country and elsewhere. He was engaged to a young lady while he was at Princeton, and he wrote to her. He said, "Everywhere we hope to have God with us, and everywhere we shall have as much work as we can possibly do. The great question is, where can we do the most for our Savior, and where would He have us go?" Well, John and Helen Nevius went to China, did a great work for God there, but most of the fruit of their labor, I am sure, is in Korea. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. Okay, a few minutes for questions. The nature of the Nevius method in church planting was really basically to attempt to have the church an independent church from the very beginning, not linked in financially or in other ways to the American church, to the sending church, or to the mission. So his concern was that the church emerge quickly, immediately, as a self-supporting church, a self-propagating church, self-governing church. Not all missions will go that way, and it's often the sending church will dominate the emerging church for a long, long time until there is some sort of traumatic division. But Nevius felt that the church should be independent of foreign entanglements from the very beginning. And I think that was a wise method. It could be misused because we should not, at any time, nobody should start churches and then ignore them in terms of their needs for help. But the American mission tended to dominate too much the emerging churches. So I think it hindered the growth and independence of these churches in different parts of the world. So by and large, I would say the Nevius method was the right way to do it. Why did the Nevius method develop? I don't think it was largely cultural concerns. It was John Nevius's conviction that this is the way it should be done. This was a biblical approach. Roland Allen and other missiologists in England were making the same point. So Nevius was not the only person thinking along these lines. But his ideas were right and at the right place and the right time for the growth of the Korean church. I'm sure there are cultural factors there. No church wants to be controlled by foreign domination. You know, one of the curious things and rather sad things to me is the way European and American churches have transported everything, everywhere. You know, the good and the bad, or the bad and the good. There was a church at one time in Singapore. This was the official name of this church. It was called the Dutch Reformed Church in America, in Singapore. And that was because Dutch Reformed people, when they came to America, they called their church for a long time the Dutch Reformed Church in America. And then when missionaries from that Dutch American church went to Singapore, the name that they gave to the new denomination in Singapore was the Dutch Reformed Church in America in Singapore. Well, people in Singapore did not need Dutch and America in their name. Why not call it the Reformed Church in Singapore? Eventually, this is what happened. The Dutch Reformed Church in America became the Reformed Church in America, as it is today, the RCA. Okay, we'll have to stop.